This is an ABC podcast.
I look forward to leading a government that makes Australians proud.
This election didn't just change a government, it was a green slide.
Safe Liberal seat, two-term incumbent, independent.
We need to go back to our values, our principles, look closely at what has happened.
The region is looking to us to work with them and to lead by example.
Welcome to the party room. I'm Fran Kelly, joining you from Gadigal land of the Eora Nation, and PK is down, sick with COVID. So a big shout out to you, PK. I know you'll be listening somewhere there. Take it easy. But never fear, because in her stead, special guest co-host today, 7:30 Chief Political Correspondent Laura Tingle joins us from Ngunnawal land. Laura, hello there.
Hi, Fran. I also send a shout out to PK, but I'd also just like to say I'm a little bit sad that you don't have the usual party music, because, you know, I didn't get to party on election night, and I was sort of, this was going to be my opportunity to get the daiquiri out and all those sorts of things, but I'll be very serious instead.
Well, you can do that, but, you know, when you're the co-host, we don't, you know, you don't get the party music, you don't get the cocktail chatter.
Damn.
You just come in, slam in for the hard analysis. That's what
right,
we like.
Right.
A few colleagues struck down by COVID over the weekend, Laura. I guess election night, a very crowded place with parties or commiserations, broadcast teams. I guess it was almost
Inevitable,
really. Lucky for Anthony Albanese, our new Prime Minister, he's been through it already, so he could jump on a plane, head to Japan as Australia's new Prime Minister. But before we get to the nuts and bolts of this government, Laura, this new government, we have a Labor government, but do we have a majority or a minority Labor government? How is that count going?
Oh, well, it's a moment-by-moment proposition still, Fran, but I think the Labor Party is still very confident it will get to a majority. And I suppose my feeling is that it's sort of so close now that it almost doesn't matter. I mean, it does, but it's not going to be something where they're hanging out for a single vote from the crossbench to get them over the line, or, you know, are going to be able to, you know, their main mandate is going to be there, but I think they will get a majority.
Mm, we might come back to that, because it might, minority-majority might make a difference to actually the running of the parliament. We'll come back to that.
Yes.
But let's deal with, there is a new government in town, a new prime minister. He's promising to be different. Let's hear a bit from Prime Minister Anthony Albanese on day one.
A government that doesn't seek to divide, that doesn't seek to have wedges, but seeks to bring people together for our common interest and our common purpose. I think that's one of the messages that came through on Saturday. People do have conflict fatigue.
Now, Laura, Anthony Albanese hitting all the high notes there, bringing people together, inclusive, changing the way we conduct politics in this country. But what will that actually look like, and how different is this government actually going to be? Do you want to chance your arm there?
I will, Fran. I think it's still sinking in a lot, how different it could be. But I think the first key to that is Anthony Albanese's reference to wedge politics. I mean, the last 3 years in particular, but even the last decade, has been so much about this sort of real wedgy politics, you know, that and about transactional day-to-day stuff, which often doesn't matter, but which is supposed to be sticking the something sharp in the hornet's nest. I think that is not Anthony Albanese's style. It's not how he got here. It's not the way he wants to operate, you know, whether or not that's just about good intentions or not. That's not what he does. So just trying to get your head around the way that, you know, dare one say, affects the news cycle is quite interesting. I mean, there's a whole generation of journalists, effectively, who don't know much different from that, who don't know an era when the story hasn't either been about wedge politics or about politics that's dominated by internal party pressures, i.e. the Coalition versus the Nats, Kevin versus Julia, all of those things. Now, I'm not
Abbott
saying...
Abbott
versus Turnbull. How did I possibly forget that one? but, I mean, I'm not saying that we're, you know, we've reached nirvana and it's all peace and love. You know, we are talking about the Labor Party. but I think Anthony Albanese is a creature of the Labor Party, where Kevin Rudd wasn't. Julia Gillard was always in trouble because Kevin Rudd was still there, and because her elevation did create such bitter divisions in the party, they aren't there. I think Anthony Albanese has an opportunity to have a lot of clear air internally. You know, if he gets a majority, he's got the chance to not sort of lord it over people, but all of the things that have divided Australia or have been used to divide Australia, and I'd give climate change as a classic example, they're not going to be there in the same way this time round. We've got a parliament in both the House of Representatives and the Senate that is basically saying we've got to do more on climate change, not, you know, not that
well,
this is just nonsense.
We've got a nation that said on Saturday night, we want to do more on climate change, haven't we, really?
Well, absolutely.
Surely that was a takeout from the vote.
That was a takeout from the vote, but my experience suggests that politicians often forget the takeout from the vote fairly quickly after an election has passed. They always say, you know, we're here for all of you and we won't let you down and all of those sort of nice platitudes. But just in the makeup of the parliament, the mood has shifted. You know, people will be looking to do more on climate change, not less. You know, the pressure on the government will be to do more, not less. And it won't be something that is used as a wedge. And I'm still sort of just trying to work out what that means for the internal workings of the coalition, for example. I mean, it could be really good or it could be really bad. But I think, you know, it is going to be very different. And I think, as the fact that the first thing that the Prime Minister had to do was to go overseas and talk to the Quad demonstrates, you know, that really illustrates the changing focus of politics. It's so much now more driven by external immediate pressures, not in a sort of sense of, oh, you know, gee, I wonder what's going to happen next there, or maybe we could, you know, intervene here. It's absolutely real and existential and has changed the way our politics is going to have to operate. And then there are all the domestic issues as well, a lot of which will be about, when you think about it, whether it's aged care or the NDIS, is about fixing the fact that the systems that governments use or have to intervene and help people aren't working.
And I mean, thus those internal pressures of those domestic policies, the huge spending policies, the NDIS and aged care, huge amount of money and resourcing and kind of intellectual heft really needed to be ploughed into those policy areas. We've got the new Treasurer, Jim Chalmers, warning us this isn't going to be pretty. It's not going to be easy. We've got some budget shocks coming. He's had a look at, I don't know, is it the blue books or the green books, whatever the books are that they look at once they take over. He's had meetings with the Reserve Bank, meetings with all the financial agencies, and he's come out and his first words is really buckle up, Australia. We're in for a bit of a shock. So that's going to be tough. And as you say, this is a moment in time when Australia is really heavily influenced by global change. China, one. What's happening in Europe with Russia and Ukraine, another. The impact on that on a whole lot of areas like energy prices, food prices, all of those things. Still, we've got the pandemic, which is having an effect on supply chain. These are major challenges for a new government, and they come at a time, and we'll be talking about these over, you know, podcasts to come, I'm sure, but they come at a time when we look at the result on Saturday night, just to sort of zoom back there for a moment, Laura, the Australian electorate split into three, effectively. Labor winning a majority of seats, we suspect, but with a minority of votes, in fact, its lowest primary vote ever, below 33%. The LNP primary vote, not much better. What does this mean for governing, and what does it mean for both major parties, and how they're going to... I mean, they'll also have an eye on trying to reposition themselves to grow that primary vote by the next election.
Mm.
How do you think that's going to play out in the governing?
Well, I think it's really interesting. I mean, obviously there's a lot of focus on the teal seats and the independents, and I'll come back to that in a minute. But I was just doing a sort of a run of the board, as they say, yesterday to see what had actually happened and, you know, how it...
Oh, I love it. I love it that you took time out to do a run of the board and find out what actually happened.
I need to get a life, I think, Fran.
This is great.
But, I mean, you look at seats that didn't change hands, right, and where there wasn't an independent running, and there are seats, say... Cunningham in New South Wales, both parties suffered a swing against them and the votes went almost equally. I could be wrong about this, but this was certainly a picture I saw in a lot of electorates where you saw votes going to Pauline Hanson and to the Greens. You know, it was a real pox on both your houses. And as you say, both parties are facing this issue of, okay, I think for Labor, the position was, that they ran so close to the government on so many issues that the electorate, to a large extent, couldn't really distinguish enough between Labor and the coalition. Now, dyed-in-the-wool Labor supporters say how outrageous. Labor had some really big policy issues out there. But the vote says, actually, there are a lot of Labor voters who wouldn't vote for Labor. They preferred to vote for the Greens, knowing that it would eventually go back to Labor, but still determined to send that message, no, not good enough, guys. You know, we're making a, you know, the Green vote was really big across the country. I mean, how many seats they eventually win, they will have an increased representation in the parliament. But more than
2 million votes, I think Adam Band is saying when he's talking about a green slide.
Yeah,
that's a huge amount of votes.
And it was across the country in the most unlikely seats. And similarly, Pauline Hanson, partly because One Nation was standing candidates in seats they'd never had before, was regularly getting between 5, 7 and sometimes 10% of the vote. So, both parties have to win those voters back who basically are disillusioned. So they're both going to have an eye on that for the next election. Coming back to the parliament, yes, it will really change things. Whether or not it's a majority, the crossbench will demand to be heard based on their mandate. It'll change the way the parliament works. Question time questions, private members' bills, matters of public importance debates. The point is, it actually reinvigorates the parliament. The House of Representatives has basically become sort of a non-entity in the last little while. It's become this thing where nobody pays any attention to it. But like the Senate, on tricky pieces of legislation, it will be something that's very important now.
It will be, and you're right. I mean, Tony Burke, who's likely to be manager of government business in the House, is already talking about, that sort of change, more private members' bill. That's clearly a tipping the hat to that giant crossbench, 16 members likely to be sitting on that crossbench, the six Teals. We've got probably four Greens and the six who are already there, plus Di Lee. That's massive. So this is what I've been wondering, Laura. If Anthony Albanese does make majority government, whether it's 76 seats or possibly 77 seats, he, in theory, doesn't need that crossbench to get legislation through the lower house. I mean, it's a different matter once he hits the Senate, but in theory. Will the temptation be to just steamroll through, or will he, and why will he, need to be more inclusive and pay sort of heed and to the crossbench?
Well, two things. One of them is the best scenario for Labor is that it's been put forward is that it could get 77 seats. Now, that's not much of a margin in a 151-seat parliament when you've got to also put one person up as speaker. So that means that the prospects are that at some stage in the parliament, the majority, if they get one, will disappear. So in a pragmatic sense, it's sort of good to have the crossbench on side. Equally, we saw in the last parliament how a few rebel coalition MPs could hold the government to ransom on particular policy issues. So not that I'm sort of seeing any particular rebels in the Labor ranks now, but if you've got a few people who get on well with you and who are basically just interested in good legislation and who you can persuade on the case, it reduces the capacity of your own backbench to muck up, shall we say.
Yeah,
And at the broader political level, if you're trying to win back this support that's sprayed out to the independents, you want to show that you've listened to the lessons that the people who voted for those people have made, or maybe you want to get the people who voted for the Greens to come back to you. So you want to sort of show that you're listening to their concerns. So now it may be that, the experience shows us that independents who get in tend to stay in. People like them and they stick with them. So in the longer term, you're probably going to be having to deal with them, but you'll be wanting to get back all of those people who voted for the minor parties instead of you to build your own primary vote. And you'll be wanting to sort of pragmatically say, well, we could be stuck with a much different parliament where there are a lot more independents in the future. I may not have the majority I've got now, and therefore it makes sense to have a civilised relationship with them.
To show good faith, so to speak. Yeah. I mean, that all makes sense. And personally, I think it's much more likely we're going to get better policy outcomes if either one of the major parties actually listens to some of these minor parties or independents.
Yeah. As we've seen in the Senate.
As we've seen in the Senate, but we've also seen it in the Gillard government. I think Tony Windsor and Rob Oakeshott came up with some strong policy ideas, particularly around water and climate, that sort of helped the government, I think, actually come up with some real change in some of their regional communities that's still doing them well today. So it can work, but Anthony Albanese and the Greens don't have a great history. Penny Wong and the Greens and the Senate don't have a great history of relationship going all the way back to the CPRS debate in 2010 with the Greens sank. I do wonder about how that's going to go, because it seems to me most in that crossbench would like Labor, for instance, to go further on the 2030 target of 43%. Labor's not going to shift. It's got a mandate, it would say. But I don't know how they're going to sort that out, really.
Well, it is interesting. And, of course, the Greens and Labor are in more direct competition than a lot of the independents are. But there are a few things here. The first one is, I thought it was really fascinating. I mean, I think Adam Band has emerged as, very interesting leader of the Greens. He's not... He's not as, ridiculously hardline as the Greens were at the time they rejected the CPRS, not as pure, shall we say, perfection and purity and all those sorts of things. He had this sort of a very simple message during the campaign, which was the headline issue was no new coal mines. Now, there's a whole range of issues around emissions reduction. That's true. Now, that no new coal mines in itself is a challenge for Labor. But that was the most headline issue that the Greens were running on. So that's something that's sort of not really sort of got a lot of attention. But that will be one that they're going to have to sort of work around. But on emissions, I think the Labor thinking is, well, look, if we legislate our various mechanisms that we've proposed, they might not look like they're all that much different. But if business knows that these sort of mechanisms are in place, that will let them invest with much more confidence. And I think that they believe, that is, Labor believes, that that will produce a lower trajectory of emissions by 2030. But I think what you're going to see, and we already saw this in the communique out of Tokyo a couple of days ago, the focus is going to shift to the 2035 target and the commitment that the government makes on that. Anthony Albanese inserted into the communique language about a new and more aggressive target for 2035 that Australia will take to the UN. And I think that's where the wriggle room will be, that they shift the debate to that and act accordingly.
Okay. Yeah, and I think the Greens are going to, obviously they're stepping up the pressure on not just new coal mines but oil and gas, but we'll come back to that. That's going to play out over this next 18 months. Laura, there's so much to talk about, but we haven't even talked about the Liberal Party yet, who had this defeat. They're now trying to regroup themselves. I think they've got the lowest number of seats, someone told me, since 1946. So they are really reduced numbers there on the floor of the House. So many Heartland seats stripped off them by the independents, and all of those who lost their seats are pretty clear of the reason. Here's Dave Sharma, who lost the seat of Wentworth.
It was almost, visceral, their reaction. They would say, that he's too religious. They didn't like that he carried coal into Parliament one time. That they didn't believe his sincerity on climate change. They didn't like our handling of Brittany Higgins and Grace Tame.
It's Dave Sharma talking about what he described as a visceral reaction to Scott Morrison in a seat like Wentworth. It was the same sort of story if you speak to some of the other members, the Teals who won in Kooyong, or the Liberal members in North Sydney, all the same story, a visceral reaction, a deep dislike for Scott Morrison, Laura. So if it was a visceral dislike of Scott Morrison, is the solution as simple as change your leader and improve your fortunes? Peter Dutton looks certain to emerge as the new Liberal leader. He's promising to show a gentler side, I kid you not, that's a quote, of his character. Now he's free of the rigours of portfolios like defence and border security. Is Peter Dutton the answer for the Liberals, do you think?
Well, a few things. Sorry, I don't have a lot of sympathy for people like Dave Sharma. You know, they had the opportunity to stand up to Scott Morrison publicly and they didn't do it. Now, you're talking about the Liberals. I think we really have to rethink the way we think about the Liberals and the Coalition from now on. Mm-hmm. The Liberals, the actual Liberals, are now a minority. I sort of think about it in three slabs. There's the Liberals, there's the LNP, and there's the Nats. And the Nats and the LNP, which is the merged Liberal and National Party in Queensland, are now the majority. The Liberals, as they currently exist, they're just a rump.
That's extraordinary, isn't it?
Yeah,
that is an extraordinary shift.
It's an extraordinary shift. And they are a very, let's be frank, a very unimpressive bunch of people. You know, a lot of their numbers are boosted by the fact that they've, you know, that people survive in the Senate because they weren't up for re-election. They're all suddenly saying, oh, yes, well, I never agreed with what Scott Morrison was doing, which I think is pretty pathetic. You know, it's very much, I think, a party that is, you know, basically dominated by the sort of Nationals institution in Queensland, not the Liberal. Yep. So, you know, and so they I think they are in a different position to Liberals in the rest of the country. So there are a few things you'd say about Peter Dutton. One of them is, because of that, he's the only person, sort of mechanically, I think, who could lead the party because, you know, the Queenslanders now dominate, as far as I can see. And, of course, when you look at it, you know, there aren't any alternatives that are serious. I mean, the names that have been thrown up in the last few days, Susan Lee, Angus Taylor and Karen Andrews, I'm sorry, but they're not leadership material. And, you know, it's astonishing that Angus Taylor was able to stay on the front bench, frankly, given his record. So he faced a very, very big swing against him in his own seat.
Yeah, he had a strong challenge from an independent as well.
Correct. You know, I think the Liberal Party has got an existential crisis. It actually has to decide, does it actually want to stay in coalition, which would be a big call, and I think they're too weak to make it. But, you know, the Nationals are still pushing to go even harder line. So the big call for Peter Dutton, whether he's, you know, going out and smiling at people and not sounding like the hard man, is, you know, which way does he jump? Does he jump? Does he jump in the face of that National pressures back towards the centre, which is where, you know, pragmatically he's got to go if he's going to win some votes back around the country? Or does he actually sort of agree that the party should be driven further to the right by the Nationals? It's a really, you know, it's a really interesting question.
And the Nationals have their flanks too. I mean, there's Darren Chester and Michael McCormick and those people speaking out against Barnaby Joyce, but then there's Matt Canavan, the new MP, Colin Boyce, who got elected up in Flynn, I think it was, who's very hard line against net zero. These are strong forces within that coalition party room that are nowhere near at peace. Laura, just before we go, let's get to policy because the election was almost a policy for his own. But now, here we are, a brand new Prime Minister, first action off to the international stage, the Quad meeting in Tokyo, a godsend for Anthony Albanese, I think, because foreign policy, not historically his strong point, but in the past, there's been a number of Prime Ministers with little interest, really, or experience in foreign affairs, who've actually turned into significant global players. Let's have a listen to Anthony Albanese as Australia's new Prime Minister on the global stage in Japan.
We will act in recognition that climate change is the main economic and security challenge for the island countries of the Pacific.
So there's, you know, Paul Keating used to say, change the government, change the nation. Well, there's a change right there, Laura, putting climate change front and centre. Now we've got Penny Wong as her second act as foreign minister going from the Quad, heading back to the Pacific to try and counter a tour of 10 Pacific countries by the Chinese foreign minister. So these are pretty significant actions being taken by this brand new government, aren't they?
They're very significant. I mean, the Quad was sort of on the calendar, so they didn't have much choice. But as you say, I think it was a really good opportunity for Anthony Albanese, a bit of a baptism of fire, but, you know, it was fine. And, you know, I think people are still getting their heads around the idea of a new prime minister, and there's nothing like seeing him on the international stage to do that. But, you know, it is a really big chance for the country to reset our language and our relationships at a really crucial point when we need to reset them. So it's actually, you know, regardless of what your politics are, it's fantastic, you know, that we are in a position to sort of start afresh, if you like. That doesn't necessarily mean we overturn anything that's happened beforehand, you know, holus bolus, but it just does give us a lot more manoeuvrability than we've had, particularly, I think, with the Pacific neighbours.
We've got former ASIO head Duncan Lewis coming out today saying Australia's, quote, been rather louder than we should have been in public criticism of China. A better approach should have been speak softly and carry a big stick. I think that's a pretty significant intervention by Duncan Lewis at this juncture. As I say, Penny Wong over there walking the walk, not just talking the talk. You know, they were very critical of Maurice Payne not going to the Solomons during that whole period around the concerns over the China Security Pact being signed. Penny Wong is showing how she thinks it should be done. And relations that you strike at the beginning of a leadership, I think, are very significant. For Anthony Albanese to be in the room with the US president, to be in the room with the Indian prime minister, Japan's prime minister, this will, as I say, stand him in very good stead, I think, not just for his confidence level, but these are critical relations to be forming at the very start of your prime ministership.
Absolutely. I think they're really, really crucial relationships. And, I mean, as you say, Duncan Lewis's intervention is absolutely fascinating. And I think as the dust settles, there are all these questions that sort of haven't, it's not that they haven't been asked, but of course they were never answered. I mean, what is AUKUS? You know, what have we actually committed to? You know, it's not just about submarines. You know, we keep being told it, you know, we're going to get all this technology and space and, you know, all sorts of stuff as a result of it. But what have we actually committed to do? I think the whole defence strategic space in terms of what we've done, what we've committed to spend, are they the right strategic decisions to make, not just in terms of materiel, but in terms of the way we're approaching our various neighbours? I think it's just, you know, it is just such an opportunity to reset and find out exactly what we've actually been talking about with all of these countries for the last few years.
Imagine being that incoming government and sort of getting a look under the hood for the first time, really, and seeing it. As I mentioned, we've got the new Treasurer, Jim Chalmers, coming out and saying, look out, I've just had a look under that hood and it ain't pretty.
Well,
you mentioned,
I mean,
defence. We're going to have to spend a lot of money on defence, and a lot has been committed. And as you say, what's the commitment we've made under these agreements?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if you noticed or not, but the number of events that the former Prime Minister did at establishments that were associated with defence, you know, companies that were building defence staff for, you know, defence-related places. Now, that was, you know, presumably because he was sort of doing the subliminal, you know, very subtly subliminal message about the Kharki election and stuff, and also just about, you know, we're spending all this money on manufacturing. But, you know, I would really love to sort of be able to stop and do a stock take and say, well, what are our commitments? What have we actually, you know, what are we doing here? Because it seems like wherever we look, they are making new commitments to build something or spend something. And I don't know how it all fits together as a whole anymore and whether it's actually the correct response. And there's another question here, which is, I think most people in Canberra see that DFAT, the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade, has been either sidelined or diminished over the last 10 years, in particular with a focus on the national security and defence establishment. All of our soft power diplomacy, our aid strategy, all of those things, you know, we have to think about both sides of our brain here and how that works together.
Yeah, and you would think that's where Penny Wong comes into the fore. I mean, they were making exactly those promises in during the election campaign with Labor's policy around the Pacific. That was exactly what they were talking about, developing that soft power. I would say that sort of fits really into her kind of wheelhouse. So let's see how they go. There's so much to be talking about. We haven't even mentioned the fact that this government is promising a referendum within this term of government on the voice to parliament, constitutional recognition for First Australians. So there's a lot of work to be done and a lot for the nation to get behind or not, really. So there's going to be some big debates, I reckon.
Indeed. It's really interesting times. I think Linda Burney has suggested that that referendum should be held as early as May next year, which is, you know, suggesting it's really going to, you know, rocket ahead. So it'll be fascinating to see how that goes.
We're going to save question time until next week when PK is back, because Laura and I had so many questions of each other. It's just, you know, we couldn't stop, really. Do remember, though, please send your questions in. We love getting them. You can tweet using the hashtag ThePartyRoom or email your questions to thepartyroom@abc.net.au. And remember, follow us, The Party Room, on your ABC Listen app or your favourite podcast app. That's it from us. Laura, fantastic. Thank you for stepping into the breach. It's great to have you here as the emergency co-host this week. Thank you.
My absolute pleasure, Fran. And get well soon, PK.
Yes, absolutely. Shout out to PK. Get well soon. See you, Laura.
See you, Fran.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.